You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The great promise of the internet to offer interconnectedness and the spread of great ideas has also brought great challenges in discerning fact from fiction. Our next guest discusses the ways that we can identify misinformation and disinformation. Damaso Reyes is a researcher, speaker, and trainer in the field of media and information literacy. An experienced journalist, his specialties include providing professional development, training for educators and journalists around the world, teaching them how to better understand the misinformation landscape and spot and fight against disinformation. Welcome, Damaso Reyes. It's great to have you here with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to start about the scope of the problem today with false information, conspiracy theories, so-called fake news. Do we have kind of an idea in terms of maybe quantifying it or some way of understanding how bad it really is?
I think the scope of the problem is, let's step back for a moment and think about the scope of social media. Social media, as we know it, Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, didn't exist 20 years ago. That's how short the cycle and transformation has been. But Facebook now has over 2 billion active users. In just a very short amount of time, we've seen a pretty significant transformation in our lifetimes, in less than one generation. We've seen a transformation in how people access and communicate information in a pretty significant way around the world. So if you think about the amount of time that most of us spend online in New Zealand, the figures that I've seen are something about 4 to 5 hours a day active online in some respect. So that's kind of the fertile ground when we talk about misinformation and disinformation. So from what we've seen and what we know, let's use the 2016 U.S. presidential cycle as an example, since for many people, that's kind of the starting point of their awareness of the scope and extent of misinformation. We know about 30 million people shared, the vast majority of them unwittingly, some form of disinformation was created by the Internet Research Agency or another Russian proxy. So that's 30 million. Now, that's just the people who shared it. Now, obviously, when somebody shares something on Facebook, other people see it. So maybe 5, maybe 10, maybe 15, maybe 20, maybe 100 if it's a particularly popular post. So we know that at least from that particular disinformation campaign, tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions of people were exposed to misinformation or this particular brand of misinformation. And then when we look in our daily lives, when we sort of look at what becomes popular, what trends, we know that false information, misinformation spreads about 6 times faster than correct information. And it can reach the most popular misinformation posts on Facebook, for example, can reach up to 100,000 people. That's each post. So the scope of the problem is pretty significant. It's not everywhere all the time, but it's pretty insidious.
There are lots of different types of misinformation, video manipulation, sort of half-truths, fake profiles, bots, intimidation. How do you sort of categorize these? And is there sort of a sliding scale in terms of what to be most concerned about?
I think we should be concerned about all of it, in part because it all kind of pollutes the information ecosystem, right? Some of it is, very obvious and sometimes very scary. But what the goal of creating disinformation and misinformation is for a lot of the entities and agents and people who do it is to really erode our information ecosystem, erode our ability to communicate with each other, to have a civil discourse, to be able to know what to believe, to be able to trust in information. So all information or misinformation in that case is actually fairly dangerous. So we do have, very broadly speaking, a number of different categories. And one thing that I think it's really important to address early on is this concept or this term fake news. And we really want to retire it because it's become this kind of catch-all pejorative term that's kind of lost all meaning. So it's not particularly useful to talk about fake news since it's such a loaded term now. But we can talk about categories of misinformation and disinformation. So we have things like manipulated content. So when we see something, let's say a picture of a famous celebrity or athlete, and they're wearing a t-shirt which espouses a political cause that they never wore. That's an example of manipulated content. Some of the content is real, but it's been altered a little bit. We see fabricated content. We see things which are photoshopped completely. Deep fakes are an example of fabricated content. These are computer-generated videos of celebrities or famous people, and you know, they're saying things that they never said or doing things that they never did. We have things like false context. So we might have a photograph or a graphic that is real, it's not been altered, but the context in which it appears is false. So it seems to lend credibility to a false claim that we might see on Instagram or Twitter. So those are some of the many different kinds of misinformation, and they all have slightly different techniques, different tactics that they use to get at us. But underlying all of this is this idea that many of the people who create misinformation, they're trying to target our emotional centers. They're trying to trigger us emotionally. They're trying to make us fearful. They're trying to make us angry. They're trying to make us worried or concerned. And by doing so, they're hoping that they can override our ability to think critically. And then we just share the information. And that's how the misinformation propagates. And that's really what we're trying to combat and what we're most concerned about. We're trying to get people to take a pause, take a beat, think about whether or not what they're about to share is actually real. And if they have any question, any doubt, we want them to not share it, because then that prevents it from propagating.
Before we get into some of the ways people can identify what might be misinformation or disinformation, let's talk about the consequences. So you mentioned eroded trust and an eroded ecosystem of information, inability to communicate civilly. What other consequences do you see from the proliferation of, you know, I would argue even, you know, these repetitive conspiracy theories that seem to be circulating quite a bit these days? How do you see that?
So we have these, you know, what some people might call these kind of abstract consequences. So the erosion of social cohesion or civil discourse, these are, you know, very big words. But what we're increasingly seeing is direct, specific harm that's being caused either to individuals or to groups. And what happens is that people get exposed to a piece of bad information. They believe it. They make a poor decision, which leads to a dangerous action. In New Zealand and in the region, we've actually had a very recent example. Last year, there was an outbreak of measles in New Zealand, which in part was fostered by a spread of misinformation around vaccines and their efficacy and their risks associated with this. And in the United States, clearly we've been riding this way for quite some time, and it's spread all over the world now, unfortunately. And so vaccination rates declined over a course of years, and there was a measles outbreak. Now, fortunately, New Zealand has an excellent healthcare system, and fortunately, nobody died. But there were children and people who were sickened and put in danger. That's a real consequence. And tragically, that measles outbreak was then exported to Samoa, where I was last week. And they don't have the same kind of robust medical infrastructure, but unfortunately, they were also exposed to a lot of the same mis- and disinformation around vaccines. And not just the misinformation, there was a series of events which led to a quite rapid lowering of vaccination rates among young people and children. And tragically, over 80 people died last year, many of them young children, because they were infected with measles. And the truth is that measles is a very dangerous disease, especially if you're a young person, especially if you don't have the kind of robust supportive care you might find in a place like New Zealand or Auckland. So misinformation has real-world consequences. It can lead to people dying. Certainly in other parts of the world, we've seen in India and Pakistan, misinformation being used against ethnic minority groups, often being spread via WhatsApp or other social media. The trope is that a specific member of a social minority group has been seen or accused of committing some kind of sexual violence against the majority group woman or girl. And so then that spreads. People get together and they decide to attack or even murder that person. We've seen examples of this, many examples of this, unfortunately, over the past few years. So far from being theoretical, misinformation causes real-world harm that we can directly see and directly measure, and it seems to be increasing.
Ordinary people are pretty busy and have, you know, work and school and kids and all of these types of things. How can they know or identify or screen out misinformation?
So I think it's really important to actually challenge this idea a little bit, because I hear it a lot. And I think about my own social media habits and information gathering habits and those of the people I know. Oftentimes, I'll be at work during the middle of the day, and I'll see friends of mine posting lots of stuff on social media. And I'm thinking to myself, aren't you at work? The truth is, we actually have a lot of time. We spend a lot of time on social media. Question is, what do we think is a good use of our time, right? And so we haven't been socialized and we haven't been taught that verifying information, questioning information is actually a good use of our time. So there's a bit of behavior modification that I think needs to happen. We need to start thinking about the consequences of accidentally sharing misinformation and why we have a social responsibility to ensure that the information we share is real and is accurate. There are a couple of, you know, relatively simple techniques that we can use to, if not verify information, certainly help prevent the spread of misinformation. And so the first thing that we should do is when we come across a piece of information, we should ask ourselves, what's the source of this information? So is the person sharing it the person who created it? Or are they sharing something that somebody else has created or that somebody else is sharing? Can we figure out who the original person is who shared it? And what do we know about this person or this entity or this group? Are they transparent? Do we know who they are? Are they hiding? Are they anonymous? Once we figured out who shared it or who created it, what else do they share? Do they share a lot of things that seem like they might be conspiracy theories or seem like they might not make a lot of sense? That could be a sign that, you know what, this might be false information or this might be misinformation too. So maybe that's 5, 10, 15 seconds into the process, right? You know, we're getting maybe yellow lights, maybe not a red light yet. When I look at the information, do I have a strong emotional reaction to it? Am I angry? Am I sad? Am I fearful? Sort of disproportionately? Does it make me want to act? Does it make me want to share because I'm operating from a very emotional place? If that's the case, that's kind of a red flag that you may be being emotionally manipulated. And so you should really take a beat here, because accurate information, fact-based information, shouldn't be emotionally manipulative. You might sort of get intellectually concerned, or you might say, hey, there's some injustice happening here, but it shouldn't make you want to punch a wall or make you fearful for what's around the corner. And often misinformation is specifically trying to target our emotional centers in the hope of overriding our ability to think critically. And then we keep going, right? 30, 35 seconds in, we start asking ourselves, well, what are the claims that are being made by this piece of information? Do they offer any evidence, or are they just making an outrageous claim, right? Oftentimes we see misinformation, it makes a claim, it provides no sources, no evidence. So if something makes a claim and it provides no evidence, if it says something like 70% of highly intelligent people eat chocolate? According to whom? What's your source? Is there a study? Does anybody corroborate this? And if they do provide a link or do provide an evidence, well, that's an opportunity to look it up. You know, we're 45, 50 seconds in. Let's do a quick Google search. Does chocolate make you smarter? And let's see if we can actually find any standards-based sources which replicate this claim. So those are some of the very simple things. Again, in sort of less than a minute, we can, if not verify a claim, we can certainly see if more questions are raised. And if more questions are raised and we can't verify something, but maybe we can't totally debunk it, at that point, we should just say to ourselves, let's stop. Let's certainly not share it. By not sharing it, we've stopped the vector of transmission and we've thwarted the people who are creating this misinformation. Because remember, the people who create misinformation proportionally to the people who are on social media are actually quite small. So they require ordinary people, unwitting hosts, let's say, if we want to use the medical example, to share this misinformation. That's the only way that it can propagate. Bots can't propagate misinformation nearly as effectively as ordinary people. And that's something that the data science is showing us quite well. They're the seeds and they often get something going, but it requires ordinary people in order for this misinformation to spread. So if we practice, internet or social media hygiene, we can actually stop this stuff from spreading.
So I noticed that there are some countries taking this on almost like a national project. Finland is one of them. What can we learn from places like Finland that are taking on teaching people while they're in school at a very young age what should be done to prevent sort of the widespread adaptation?
I think that what's great about these efforts is that we're seeing them take it extremely seriously. We're seeing countries begin to take this as a kind of national emergency, as seriously as making sure young people are vaccinated, or as seriously as they should be taking climate change. It really requires a fundamental rethinking of how we educate young people. And that rethinking has to be centered around critical thinking, not just absorbing information and being able to repeat it, you know, as many of us learned when we were in secondary school or primary school, but really be able to critically assess information, being able to find sources of information, being able to independently analyze information and interpret it for other people. And that's a different way of teaching than, you know, most of us learned in certainly in the 20th century. And it requires also retraining how we teach teachers. But this is how we're going to deal with this problem. It's not going to be a local municipality or even a province or a state. This really has to be begin to be addressed on a national and a in multinational level, because the problem doesn't respect borders. It doesn't respect language. You have, as we saw in 2016, young teenagers in Macedonia monetizing misinformation during the U.S. election cycle. So we need to start treating the problem as an international, certainly as a national level problem. And oftentimes it's national governments that have the weight and have the money to begin to demand these sorts of reforms and to support educators and parents as they begin to address this issue.
You know, you bring up another really important point, which is the monetizing of information and the sort of what we would call the political economy of media, including Facebook and Google and whatever, I mean, the Macedonians, that whole idea of making money from either informing or misinforming or getting people emotional. And I would say there's a big scale, sort of a long spectrum of how that is done. And today there's the people who try to get our emotions by misinformation or by mischaracterizing or giving a narrative, as you said, that might get people to pay attention. But there's also the problem of paywalls. And so it becomes harder and harder to get good journalism.
I'd push back on that just a little bit. First, even in the land of paywalls, we have more free access to information than at any time in human history, certainly in any time in recent memory. The vast majority of information is still free and still accessible, at least to a limited extent. Usually the problem is not that people are doing their diligent search and then they come up to a paywall and then they give up. That's not at least what I'm seeing. I don't know what other researchers and experts in the field are seeing. But what we do need to do and what we do need to acknowledge as a civil society is that journalists need to be paid. You know, journalists work incredibly hard and news organizations spend a lot of money verifying and doing this hard work. So how are we going to support that? There's an argument, perhaps, that some people might say that information wants to be free, that this sort of very important civic information needs to be free. Okay, if that's the case, how do we then support quality journalism? Are we asking the government to subsidize it? Are we asking philanthropists to subsidize it? I don't think there's any one model, but the truth is, whether it's in our everyday lives, getting a coffee, or the things we spend money on online, things like Netflix, people don't question whether or not they should pay for a Netflix or an iTunes subscription. They say, okay, well, I get value out of this. And I can't get this anywhere else unless you want to pirate or torrent, which the average person maybe doesn't have the technical skill or desire to do that. But they've sort of been after, you know, the Wild West days of the early internet where everything was free, people began to be accustomed to paying for entertainment. And now you have Apple TV and Netflix and Amazon Prime and all these things that are making significant amounts of money because every month people say, okay, I'll give you my 5 euros or my 10 New Zealand dollars or my $15 for Netflix because I'm getting something out of it, something I value. We have to, and I say we, and I'm a journalist, journalists need to make their case. We need to help the public understand that the information that we work so very hard to produce is worthy of paying for. And places like the New York Times have been very successful and made a lot of money doing that. But we haven't yet as a society changed our thinking, our behavior when it comes to news, that's worth paying for. We've largely done it when it comes to entertainment. And that shift has happened. But I think the next shift needs to be that we need to see this as a valuable resource.
So one of the things that has eroded over the last 30 years, particularly in the United States, where you're from, is trust in journalism. And that has come from other types of media organizations that have potentially an economic benefit by targeting standard traditional ethical journalism. And then when you add the paywall to it, and I'm certainly not arguing that there's not a cost to producing good journalism, but I'm talking about a general information ecosystem that you brought up at the very beginning. So it's kind of a perfect storm in some ways, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what's important to recognize is that journalism organizations, specifically corporations, did a really, really lousy job of monetizing the internet in the first 10 or 15 years of the 21st century. They were giving away internet ads as part of a bundle if you bought a print ad. They were really devaluing their own product and also giving it away for free. So you're training the consumer to expect that this is free and to value it that way. So the media organizations and corporations have a lot of blame to bear. But this erosion of trust, you know, it comes from a couple different directions. First of all, there are actors, for lack of a better word, who their goal is to erode that trust because they have their own agenda or they want you to trust them and not trust someone who will maybe expose what they're doing. So that's one thing. Politicians can be guilty of this. There are state actors who have been trying to do this for generations, not just recently. The other thing is, you know, over the past 30 years, there's just been a tremendous amount of competition in the information game. When I was a school-aged kid, if something called itself news, I could trust that it had been created by a journalist for the purpose of informing me and checked by an editor. Now I have no such assurance. Lots of people calling themselves journalists, lots of things calling itself news. There's just more information out there than I ever had to deal with as a kid. So it's not just an erosion of trust. There's just more choice out there. And of course, the challenge is those other forms of information are targeting our emotional centers. They're targeting our biases. They're tailoring information to what we want to hear, not necessarily what we need to hear. And it's really hard to compete against that. So do I want to eat my vegetables and learn about what's happening in the local city council meeting? Or do I want a funny meme or a funny joke video? If I don't know the value, the comparative value of those things, if I haven't been taught those things in school, yeah, of course I'm going to choose the candy. Certainly we have to begin to address socially and through education the actual media landscape we live in. As adults, we're often teaching the way we were taught, which was for a very different kind of media landscape. And I think journalists obviously have a role. We have to be much more transparent in our work. We have to do much more around engagement. There are many of my colleagues, unfortunately, still think that, hey, we tell the truth, we're the authority, believe us, that's enough. Well, we're in a very competitive information market space, and as distasteful as I think it is for some older journalists and even some younger journalists, we have to make our case. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with proving why we're trustworthy. There's nothing wrong with being transparent about how we do our work. If anything, it makes people more passionate about our work, and it makes us seem more trustworthy than the other people out there creating mis and disinformation who aren't being transparent.
Well, Tomaso Reyes, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
Tomaso Reyes is a researcher, speaker, and trainer in the field of media and information literacy.